Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
We would like to look this evening at interpreting the miraculous. We'd like to start off looking at some of the biblical terminology that's used for miracles, just some of it. Then we want to discuss briefly the recognition of miracles. How do you recognize a miracle when you see one? Thirdly, the significance of miracles. And then, if my tape has not run out, we would like to interpret a particular miracle just as kind of a specimen to see some of the sort of things that might be done that I trust will be valid. Let's look first of all then at some of the biblical terminology used for miracles in Scripture. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 34, we have a cluster of a number of the terms in Scripture in the Old Testament used for the miraculous. I'll start back in verse 33. Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire, as you have heard it, and survived? Or has a God tried to go and take out for himself a nation from within another nation, by trials, by signs and wonders, by war and by mighty hand, by outstretched arm and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? There are several terms used there for the miraculous, and actually two of the three commonest terms in the Old Testament occur in that passage. One's translated signs, and the other one translated wonders. We'd like to look then at some of these Old Testament words used for the miraculous. The commonest term in the Old Testament for a miracle is the term oat. The word occurs about 80 times, usually translated sign. It's not a word that's used for miracles all the time. It has a number of non-miraculous uses. It's used for a symbol, something, used for a pledge, term used for a pledge to guarantee that something's going to happen. It's a term used for a memorial sometime. If you want to remember something, a memorial that is set up can be called an oat. And it's sometimes used for an ensign. Don't know whether that would have been a flag or some kind of a placard or a symbol or something that's carried on the pole before an army in battle, that sort of thing. So the term oat has this whole range of non-miraculous uses. And they give us, I think, a little picture of some of the background of the use of the term oat as a word for a miracle. Used as a miracle, it means that kind of a miracle which signifies or guarantees something or points out something. So the emphasis on the word oat, which I say is a rather common Old Testament word, is the significance of the miracle. It's a pointer to something. It is to perhaps remind you of something or to guarantee something. Another word which is used in the Old Testament rather commonly, about 35 times, is the word ophet. And this word is sometimes translated sign, sometimes translated wonder. It's used mostly miraculously. It does not seem to have much of any use for non-miraculous occurrences. It's occasionally, however, used for a person or an event or something like that that is symbolic of something that God is going to do, what we might call a prophetic sign of some variety, where the thing itself is not miraculous, but this thing symbolizes something that's going to happen, and God knowing it's going to happen is prophetic or miraculous in that sense. So it seems to have a connection with things that are miraculous all the time. So we would translate this sign or wonder. And then there's a third Old Testament word used for miracles, niflaot. Niflaot, usually translated wonder or marvel. It occurs about 45 times. It comes from a verb in Hebrew. In fact, for those who've had some Hebrew, it's a nifal participle of a verb. The verb itself means to be too hard, or to be too difficult, or to be extraordinary, or to be marvelous. So the construction here would be that which is difficult, that which is hard, that which is extraordinary, that which is miraculous. So the emphasis of the word then is on the unusual nature of the event. It's quite frequently used of God's wonderful acts in redeeming men, redeeming Israel, or God's wonderful acts in bringing judgment upon mankind. Those then are the basic Old Testament words. You occasionally have idioms like outstretched arm, upraised hand, things of that variety, which probably are based on the idea that when you stretch your arm out or when you raise your hand, you're getting ready to do something powerful. Not perhaps thinking of raising your hand to get attention or something, although perhaps even that might be involved. But I think more the idea of something that involves power in some way. In the New Testament, there are also three common words and then several words which occur once or twice only. One of the very common words in the New Testament, occurring about 75 times, is the word we pronounce Simeon. Simeon. This is used very commonly in John. It's his favorite word for miracle. And it, like the word oat in the Old Testament, is a word that means sign. And again, this has a non-miraculous use, just as the word oat in the Old Testament did. It's a word that's used for a distinguishing mark. How do you tell the difference between one thing and another? Well, a sign marks off the one thing to distinguish it from the other. It's also used for a military signal, whether an audible signal, such as we might think of a trumpet sound, or whether the person raises his arm and gives a signal to the troops to sneak up on some town or something like that, where he's transmitting information by a signal of some variety. It's also used for a mnemonic device, something that helps you to remember something else. Rather common use, not a New Testament use, but used outside the New Testament that way. The word Simeon is also used for symbolic action, some kind of an action that gives you a picture of something else, doing something symbolically. The Old Testament prophets, of course, were often engaged in symbolic actions. You remember, for instance, Jeremiah, I believe it was, goes and buys a piece of pottery at the potter's, and then he goes out and calls together the leaders of Israel and begins to tell them what's going to happen to Israel because of their sins. And at a climactic point in his discussion, he throws the piece of pottery down the ground and it smashes into 150 pieces. And he says, that's what's going to happen to Israel. It was a very striking symbolic action. The miraculous use of this word Simeon, then, is rather like that of oat. It's the idea of a miracle which points beyond itself, points to something beyond itself, a deeper significance, or points, says something about the one who is doing it, something of that variety. The second word we want to look at, not the second most common, however, is the word teros. Teros occurs only about 15 times in the New Testament. This was the favorite pagan term for miracle in the Greek language. And it has the idea of a wonder, something that people are amazed at, a portent, something that's an omen of something that's about to come, or a prodigy, an event that is totally unexpected, even grotesque, perhaps, would often be used. The idea of perhaps a sheep giving birth to a pig or something like that would be considered a prodigy, something very strange. You see things like that now and then in Greek literature. This idea, then, that is most conveyed by the word teros is the idea of a miracle as being something startling or amazing. It's interesting that a New Testament never occurs by itself. It always occurs with another word. Almost always it's with the semeion. So it has the idea that a startling or an amazing event, which, however, is not left without significance by the Bible writers, but always points to something that you should be able to learn something from. The last word in the New Testament we want to look at is the most common of the words in the New Testament for miracle. It occurs about 120 times and is the one that's usually translated miracle. It's the word dunamis. It is, however, very frequently used non-miraculously. In fact, a large number of these 120 times are non-miraculous uses. It's the word that means power. We get the words dynamic, dynamite, dynamo, and various things of that sort from this particular Greek word. It means power. Strength, that sort of idea, or ability, or sometimes resources. A person may have a lot of dunamis if they've got a lot of wealth, or if they've got a large room full of food, or something of that variety would be considered dunamis. Resources to carry out something else. When it's used miraculously, then, the idea of dunamis carries the thrust of a miracle as being due to a higher power. A miracle involving particular power, particular ability. Notice power does not mean necessarily energy or something as, well, if the physicist lurking in the audience, energy expended per unit time or something like that would be power. No, we're not talking in those kind of terms. But ability, resources, power. And so a miracle that indicates great power or ability, that sort of thing. Well, these then are the six commonest words used in the Old and New Testament to represent a miracle. They give us, I think, a little bit of insight into what the Bible will have to say about recognition of miracles. So why don't we turn then next to recognition of miracles? How do we recognize a miracle in the biblical accounts? Well, one rather simple way, of course, is when you see something happen in a biblical account that you know from your own experience doesn't naturally happen. Someone walks on water. How many people have you seen walk on water? Well, of course, when it rains and the sidewalk is wet, you walk on water, something like that. But that's not quite what's involved. You're aware of that. And even though there have been a lot of remarks like, well, the ancients were really rather dumb, they didn't know much science, things of that sort, it's really quite amazing that the biblical miracles aren't the sorts of things that we know how to explain today. That they all were wowed by a comet or something going overhead. But comets don't go overhead very fast, I might point out to those of you who in the astronomy. But basically, the picture in the biblical material is the idea of something that people, by common understanding of what things do happen regularly around them and what everyday life is like, recognize that something quite unusual has happened here. Or when you think about the opening of the Red Sea, or you think about the feeding of the people in the wilderness with manna, or you think about the floating of the axe head, things of that variety, you can see rather easily that those are things that nobody has learned to duplicate today. We don't see how Moses really did it or something of that variety. So I think that is a rather important feature. A way in which we do not recognize the miraculous in Scripture, should point this out, is just by a remark, God did thus and so. The Bible will frequently say God did thus and so, and you might say, well, it doesn't say that it happened naturally. It says God did it. That must be a miracle. But you will get misled rather easily if you look at it from that point of view, because the Bible speaks regularly of God doing all things which come to pass, and God is spoken of as doing things which even in ancient times men knew happened, we might say, naturally in some sense. But the point is, God has created the whole world, and he sustains the whole world continually, and therefore the Bible can regularly speak of God doing things where we would not call them miraculous, we would call them providential. That is, things that happen, let's say for a moment, in accordance with natural law, but which, because God has made the natural law, because he continually upholds the universe, these things can still be spoken of as God doing them. So, for instance, you remember, as Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, that God causes his sun to rise on the just and unjust, causes the rain to fall upon them. That's not that Jesus somehow thought that there were no natural phenomena associated with these, but that all actual events in the universe that are not the creations of sinners are traceable back to God. We have another good example of that in the Psalms, many of them, but Psalm 104, some good examples of references to God doing various things, which seem, as far as we can tell, to be natural events. Psalm 104:20, the psalmist speaking to God, "You appoint darkness and it becomes night, in which the beasts of the forest prowl about." So you appoint darkness, speaking of the sun setting apparently, but using it as though God is directly doing something. Well, he's the ultimate cause, and so we can speak of God doing that. Verses 27 through 29, speaking of the animals, "They all wait for you to give them their food in due season. You give to them, they gather it up. You open your hand, they are satisfied with good. You hide your face, they are dismayed. You take away their spirit, they expire and return to their dust." A picture here where at least several of these actions would seem to be what we would consider natural actions, though they might be calamities of some variety. So the Bible often uses direct language for what we would call non-miraculous events, merely speaking of ultimate cause or a cause back up the line somewhere. We're told, for instance, in perhaps a classic passage, that God caused David to number Israel. And we're told in one another, a parallel passage to it, Satan caused God to number Israel. And we're told in one of those two passages that God told Joab to get out there and number Israel. And I suspect that Joab got a few assistants to actually go knock on the doors. What you're really seeing there is a chain of causality. And at the ultimate end of it, there's God, who's working all things together for good to those that love him, everything in control. He has allowed Satan to do something in David's life to get David to number the Israelites, which David was not supposed to do. Satan did not have in mind advancing God's glory. He was working out something else. But because he doesn't control things, he did not succeed in getting his results to be carried out. David orders the subordinate to do it. The subordinates order further subordinates to do it. You see this picture. So we need to realize that in what we call natural phenomena, you presumably have something of that sort too, although you may not have persons in many of the steps. And so a statement that God did it or Satan did it, etc., doesn't necessarily follow that you're talking about a miracle. Rather, I think we can see from these six words that we have up here that the biblical definition of a miracle is nicely suited to us. It's phenomenological definition, not a causal definition. It doesn't say a miracle is something that's caused immediately by God or immediately by Satan or something of that variety. That's the way we tend to define miracle, but then it makes it very tough to recognize it because we can't see the causality. But the biblical terms speak, several of them here, the idea of wonder, marvel, the idea of a wonder or portent or prodigy, the idea of a miracle in the sense of something that takes great power, those look at it from a phenomenological sort of view. They say a person who has grown to maturity with average intelligence has by then learned what sort of things basically happen and what sort of things don't happen and will recognize an unusual event when he sees one. So if you like, a phenomenological definition of a miracle would be a unusual event, an event which, as far as you can tell, just doesn't happen by itself, so to speak. Now, the Bible has a great deal more to it than that, and we see that in the other words, ot, mophet, and sineon, the idea of the miracle as pointing to a greater significance, that miracles aren't just things sitting there, wow, to wow the audience or cause people to wonder what's happening, but rather intended to teach something. And so that's rather significant, too. So from the biblical language, I think we can see that we can operate with a rather simple definition. It depends upon common sense, basically. What people understand do happen naturally. Things happen naturally, if you like. What things are unusual, what things are common every day. Now, that's not 100% definition. That's not a definition that will solve every case. But it's a definition that will solve in a lot of cases. And we can see that the ancients, not knowing about quantum mechanics and the laws of gravitation and all sorts of things like that, still knew a miracle when they saw one. Even the pagan accounts regularly tend, when they describe miracles, to describe things that, in fact, we still don't know how they happened. So occasionally you'll get the pagan accounts of excitement over a comet, perhaps excitement over a supernova or things of that variety, or some fairly unusual atmospheric phenomena. But St. Elmo's fire, a type of electric discharge from pointed objects under certain circumstances. But normally, there are things that just we don't know how to do. So, and we kind of think don't happen naturally. So that, I think, is significant. We might consider, in dealing with the whole matter of recognition of miracles, the question, is a miracle a violation of natural law? Is that what we mean by miracle? As I say, I think the biblical picture here of a phenomenological picture, an unusual event, is much safer. And the reason for that is we have been very commonly used to the idea of natural law for many centuries now. And by the way, the Bible also pictures natural law as well. It speaks of God having made a covenant with the sun and moon and stars. And what is a covenant? But a legal arrangement which binds parties, just as laws are legal arrangements which bind parties. So it's using just another picture of the same sort of thing. Yet the problem we have here is that we just don't understand the universe. You may well say we understand the universe in a lot of areas a whole lot better than people did 50 years ago or 100 years ago. That's probably true. But we don't really understand the universe. suppose I ask you, well, what causes rain? Well, the answer to that's much more complicated than you might think. You might say, well, water falling from the sky causes rain. Well, it is rain, but we don't have to hassle that too much. You might back up a little bit and say, fine particles in the atmosphere around which water collects, plus a certain temperature pressure arrangement so that they can collect, is what causes rain. Well, you haven't explained it yet. How did the particles get in the atmosphere? How did the water get in the atmosphere? How did you get that temperature, etc.? And you find out then you're going to have to deal with things like the rotation of the Earth. You have to deal with the distance of the Earth from the sun. You're going to have to get into the question of what produces the heat in the sun. And then you can explain that and you say, well, what produces the heat in the sun are certain reactions inside the nucleus. But what produces those? And you can keep going back and back. And you don't have to go back too far before you get out to where we don't know anything anymore. So although there are people that speak very confidently, Boltmann speaks very confidently about the idea of the universe being a closed system of cause and effect by which he thinks he can rule out the miraculous, we don't know that. We don't even know for sure how it works. Now, we have an advantage believing the Bible, and that is we know who's behind it all, and we know what he's like, and we know what he's doing. We don't know the details of what he's doing all the time, of course not, but we know his big program, That's an advantage in a sense, but on the other hand, it's quite often that we can't get from there down to where the science reaches. We can't cover the whole sequence of causes between the ultimate cause, God, and the kind of causes that we can actually investigate down here. So the whole question of trying to answer whether or not a miracle is a violation of natural law really goes beyond what we know. And so it's difficult to say. We can certainly picture some types of miracles as not being violations of natural law at all. For instance, I have a cup of water sitting here on the table. I can pick up like that. And I've watched cups of water a number of different times. I've never seen them rise off the table by themselves. I've seen people pick them up many, many times, set them back down. And yet we would say, well, in one sense, the rising of a cup from a table is a natural phenomenon. But that's only because we're used to people and used to people doing things, and people can do things like override the force of gravity in a limited sphere and things of that variety. We don't know, for instance, that the activity of Satan or the angels or such in working miracles might not only be not violating natural laws in any strict sense, but only operating with ranges of powers and things of that variety that we don't have, or operating on the basis of laws that we don't understand. That's certainly quite possible. I think we would all understand from a biblical perspective that God created natural law when he created the universe. And so he can supersede natural law, at least in the sense of getting it started and turning it off and things of that variety. So perhaps many of God's miracles supersede natural laws of some variety. But we don't know that all of them do. We'll try and look at some things along the line a little bit further in trying to deal with those particular matters. So in dealing with recognition of miracles, we've seen a little bit about the biblical language. It uses causal language rather regularly, but it uses that for non-miraculous events as well. God did something, Satan did something, etc. And that won't tell you which is a miracle or not. It uses phenomenological languages, unusual event, the event has certain significance. But whether or not it's a violation of natural law depends on our knowing more about natural law than we know. So probably some miracles are violations of natural law. Probably some things we'd call miracles are not violations of natural law. They're just things that invisible beings such as the angels and the demons can do, and we can. We have another problem in defining miracles, and that's the problem of unbelief. I suppose most of you by now, with liberalism going strong for a century and a half, have run into various liberal attempts to explain the miraculous. Liberalism is basically characterized by the idea that miracles don't occur. And so they have some alternatives for miracles. One type of alternative was very common early in the last century, 18, 20, 30, 40, 50, only survives in a few remnants today. That's a so-called rationalistic model of miracles. In the rationalistic model, the events which occurred in Jesus' ministry that we would call miraculous really happened, but they weren't really miracles. What they really were is they were natural events. But the disciples were a little on the slow side, and they didn't really realize that. So this was popularized by Hermann Paulus in his Life of Christ, and basically his idea was when Jesus was thought to be walking on the water, he was really walking on the shore. But it was night, and the disciples didn't notice. Of course, when Peter stepped out of the boat, he wasn't walking on the shore. Went down rather quickly. Luckily, Jesus was nearby, could reach out and pull him in. Another variety of that, which is a little more clever perhaps, is that Jesus is walking on a sandbar. So here they are, 300 feet out in the out from the shore, but there's a sandbar, Jesus walking along. Then when Peter steps out, then you can have Peter actually walking on the water for a little bit. He steps on the sandbar too, walks a few steps, looks around at the wave, steps in a hole, shoom, gets pulled out. So that would be an example of rationalizing miracles. Another example, one probably the one which is most popular still in liberal circles, is the feeding of the 5,000. Now, to actually get all of that food for 5,000 out of 5 loaves and 3 fishes is impossible according to liberalism because miracles don't happen. How could it happen? Well, half of the people out there had their lunches, but they thought they were the only people with lunches, and they weren't about to bring out their lunches and have 4,999 people looking at them, so they kept them hidden. But when this little kid came forward and volunteered his lunch, well, everybody pulled out their lunches and everybody had enough, all sorts left over, rationalizing miracles. They get better when Paulus begins to attack the question of the transfiguration and the ascension. The transfiguration, Jesus and two to three disciples were up on the mountain. They were up there all night, and the disciples got very tired, and so they're about half asleep as the sun begins to rise. When these two fellows from Jerusalem come up to talk to Jesus, and the sun is shining through the clouds, and it's shining through their hair and their clothes and everything. So Jesus and the two fellows from Jerusalem, with their backs to the sun, and the other guys on the other side of them, look like they're lit up like all this. And as we can see from Peter not quite knowing what to say, he was half asleep anyway. And so that's what the real transfiguration was all about. A last example before we leave the whole area of rationalizing attempts to avoid the miraculous would be the ascension. Here's Jesus. We won't get into how he got out of the tomb and all of that, though that is explained by Paulus as well. He's about to leave his disciples for the last time and go off and die somewhere. They're standing over on the Mount of Olives. Handily enough, it's a foggy morning again. He turns after saying the last words to them and walks up the hill into the clouds. And the two fellows from Jerusalem, it's lucky they were around there again to be mistaken for angels. They say, well, you fellows, get on it. Don't just stand here looking up the hill all this time. Jesus will be back, etc. So they go get to it. Well, those are the rationalistic type of explanation of miracles. They're not very common today. I think the problem was that they were so ludicrous that even few liberals could swallow that sort of situation. And besides, within a few years, another alternative had come along, and that was the mythological explanation of miracle. Another problem of unbelief in regard to the recognition of miracle. The mythological explanation basically says nothing of that sort actually happened. If you were there with a camera to take a picture of what was going on, you wouldn't have anything to take pictures of. Whereas on the other one, you would have had Jesus standing on the sandbar and the fellows pulling out their lunches and Jesus walking up the hill. But no, in the mythological view, you wouldn't have anything to take a picture of that sort. The stories were all invented later. The original idea here, I think, that Strauss proposed was that the miracles were intended to teach religious notions. The incarnation, the miracle of the incarnation, was intended to teach the religious notion that man is the nearest thing to God, and that God and man are really one. And by teaching the incarnation, we can learn that God and man are really one, and we can fan up the spark of the divine that is with us in us until it bursts into flame, something of that variety. More recent mythological explanations tend to avoid the sort of idea that it's teaching some other sorts of thing, but usually try to come on with the idea, well, ancient men were trying to explain who Jesus was, and anybody that was important in ancient times had to have miracles attributed to them. So naturally, Jesus had to have miracles attributed to him. So you will get a fair amount of that sort of mythological explanation today among New Testament theologians. Or another form that you often get, Jesus is the new Moses. Jesus is going to lead his people out of bondage to sin and lead them into the promised land, etc. All of which I think has some biblical merit. And therefore, since Moses is supposed to have done this and this and this and this, which the New Testament scholars on the base of the Old Testament scholars will say, Moses never did those anyway, but that's what was understood in New Testament times, then Jesus has got to do the kind of things Moses did. So those would be the sort of things you will get out of mythological explanations in. The idea that there's some deeper theological significance to the event which never happened. It's just you allegorize the event to find out what it represents. Or that someone who is great just would be expected to do miracles, so you have to invent stories about him. Or Jesus is the new Moses, and therefore whatever Moses did, Jesus must do. So those are the sort of things that are a problem from the side of unbelief, a feeling by persons that somehow science has put us in a rational world that we can all understand and banish the whole idea of demons and other frightful ideas, and therefore we can't, if we're going to be up-to-date theologians, we can't believe in the miraculous, so we have to do something else. But you really have to bend and twist the biblical material very heavily to go in these particular directions. When you look at the reactions of the disciples, you find out that they were not ignoramuses. They were surprised by the miracles. They were not expecting a miracle every day, though Oral Roberts would have told them to. They were surprised every time one happened. They were not immediately ready to believe miracles when they heard about them. The disciples did not stay where they were when the women came with the report of the angels. They went to look for themselves. And even some hours later, when the two were on the road to Emmaus, they only say, women came with some kind of report of the tomb being empty and the angels, and the fellows went down there, and they found the tomb empty, but they didn't see any angels. and goes on. You kind of obviously get the idea that the fellows aren't quite sold on the angels having actually appeared. And Thomas, hearing from people he's known for several years, is still not about to believe Jesus has risen from the dead until he sees for himself. So minimum you're going to have to say is if those miracles didn't really occur, the fellows that put it together were very clever because they made the disciples skeptical, but won over by the force of the evidence, things of that variety. So there are some real problems with trying to get away from the miraculous having actually occurred. There's a third problem, however, or maybe it's a fourth problem, with the recognition of the miracle, and that's the problem of the boundary between what we would call providence and the miraculous. We use the term miracle perhaps too loosely, but I'm not so sure about that. We certainly use the term miracle for regeneration. That's very fair, I think. Although you realize no flash of light normally occurs or anything of that sort, yet the change occurs, we're told from the biblical account, is something that would not happen by itself, and something that makes of the person something he never would have been otherwise. Well, that would certainly be a miracle in one sense, in the sense that an intervention of God is necessary to produce it. Certainly, if you know the person well and you see the change in their character, there's going to be something very striking there even as well. And I think we can even find that the regeneration has significance, things of that sort. What about unusual answers to prayer, though? You know, you're out of money, and tuition payment is coming up. And you pray about it, and you go to your mailbox the next day, and lo and behold, you open the mailbox, and there's an envelope from somebody you've never heard of before, and you pull out a check, and it's the right amount, etc. I think it's fair to call that a miracle. But that's not a miracle in the sense, apparently, of a violation of natural law. We have no particular reason to believe that God created that envelope with a check in it in your mailbox. I don't know how many people have run these things down, but usually when you run it down, you find out that, in fact, there was a person on the other end that wrote the check and that he knew about you somehow or another, things of that variety, and just for some reason, he or she sent that check. So, yeah, it's a miracle in one sense. And, in fact, I think it's a miracle in a biblical sense, an unexpected happening that has some significance. But in the sense that we have perhaps our philosophical sense of a violation of natural law, no, I don't think it is. I think in looking at this whole matter of the recognition of miracles, there are two dangers we want to avoid in the whole matter, particularly in the matter of interpreting the miraculous in the Scripture. One of them, the more dangerous, I think, is what we might call a naturalistic tendency. And that is a tendency to minimize the miraculous. Say, well, let's see, can I figure out any way that could have happened naturally? Well, if I can figure out a way that could have happened naturally, then that's the way it happened. Okay, that is the tendency, obviously, that's going on in liberalism, though the minimum they think you can get along with is zero miracles. Once in a while, you run into a liberal that goes for one or two or three, maybe, a resurrection, perhaps, and the incarnation, maybe, something like that. But normally, try to avoid that. There's another danger on the other side, however. It is perhaps not quite as dangerous, although I think there's some severe danger to it, and that's what we might call a supernaturalistic tendency, and that is to maximize the miraculous. That's to say, okay, anything that seems unusual at all, that must be a violation of natural law. God must have stepped in and done that. And so if you say something about, well, the Bible mentions wind and blowing those quail over so they'd be in the right place where the Israelites were to eat them, they say, hold it, fellow, what are you doing? Trying to explain away the Bible, you know, the miraculous or something of that sort? No, trying to deal with the passage. If the passage mentions wind, God had some reason to mention it. He happens to mention it also in the opening of the Red Sea. I don't know what part it took. We weren't there, and so we can go on what was stated. Basically, I think our desire here would be, in interpreting the miraculous, is to make miraculous what actually was miraculous, and not make miraculous what wasn't miraculous. We do need to realize that God is the author of both. God is the one who created the universe, and he created it with some kind, apparently, of a system of laws. I think it's fair to use those terminology. We don't know to what extent they are and can be broken. But he made that, and he put us in it to live in it. And so that is the way he normally works. But he has reasons to intervene in it. And when he does intervene in it, we ought not to be trying to explain it away. And on the other hand, when there are things we ought to be doing in regard to our living in a natural world, rather than expecting him to come bail us out all the time, we ought to be operating in that way. So Jesus, for instance, refused to throw himself off the pinnacle of the temple, even though God had promised him he would bail out one who is righteous and not let their foot dash against a stone. My father promised to bail me out when I graduated from college, but he said, basically, you're on your own. If you get in trouble, I can help you out financially. He did not expect me to be getting in trouble all the time and come to him to be bailed out, that was a great sign of faith or something of that sort. He expected me to be trying to do with what I've got, what I could. So in the recognition of the miraculous, we need to, I think, avoid both these dangers. We need to try and find out what we actually can about what happened in regard to the miraculous. But understanding that we don't know much about what nature is like, except in a common sense, sort of everyday experience sense, plus the additional things that have been learned by science, there'll be many places where there might be four or five ways we can think of that God could have worked something, and we don't know which way he did it, but they're all consistent with the biblical data. Well, let's turn and look a little bit then at the significance of miracles. What is the significance of miracles? That they have a significance, I think, is rather clearly seen by the fact that two of your most common words, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, are translated sign, the idea of something which is significant. Some of the others help us a little bit, perhaps, to see what is significant about them, though perhaps not as much as we might like. I think one thing they indicate is that miracles attest to us the presence of what we'll call a supernatural power. Now, by supernatural power here, I don't mean to press that they have to necessarily be violations of nature. I mean they're doing things that don't, quote, naturally happen in our normal understanding of the matter. When we see something happening that doesn't naturally happen, there's reason to believe that we have present a supernatural power. Notice some examples of this in Scripture in which that significance comes across rather clearly. In Exodus chapter 3, Moses comes in contact with God, the west side of the wilderness. Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 9. Now Moses was pastoring the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. Notice marvel, Moses, an ancient, didn't know all the things and ins and outs about modern science. He still knew that when you burn bushes, that eventually they use up the fuel and stop burning. So he goes over to see what's going on. The Lord appears to him and explains what he's going to do. So here we have an attestation of the presence of a supernatural power. And then just shortly after this, when Moses is about to go down to Egypt and to appear to Pharaoh and talk to the Israelites and stuff, he says, how am I going to sell them on this program you've got set up for me? And to attest the presence of more than Moses in this whole operation, God gives Moses some signs to do. And one of these is to take his staff and throw it on the ground. And it turns into a snake. And then pick it up, the right end, and it turns back into a staff. And the other one is to put your hand inside your cloak, and when you bring it out, it's covered with leprosy. Put it back, bring it out, it's okay again. Both of these pictures, then, we see a rather important thing, attesting the presence of a supernatural person. Notice over in Deuteronomy, when Moses is beginning to prepare the Israelites for the coming of prophets, that the same idea is seen. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 1 through 5, God says of prophet, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, and it goes on. We have a picture here of a person trying to get attestation that he's from God, that he's got something more than the average person does, and you should listen to him and pay attention to his message and things of that variety. God goes on to speak about the problems of this particular type of prophet, but it lays a presumption for us that a prophet, when he showed up and says, thus says the Lord, that they would expect that if he's claiming to have direct message from God, he would have some evidence of it, and that evidence would naturally be conveyed by the miraculous. Likewise, Jesus' activities are seen clearly throughout Scripture to attest the presence of supernatural power. In John chapter 20, the last couple verses, verses 30 and 31, the writer says, many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. These are to attest who Jesus is and cause you to believe that and to depend upon his claims. We'll picture again that sort. The apostles had the same thing with regard to them. The works that they did were attestation that they weren't just somebody who came wandering down to decide to get a religion going, that in fact they had some kind of a supernatural power. Look with me, if you will, in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. If the word spoken through angels proved unalterable and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was at first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard, God also bearing witness with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit, according to his own will. It was confirmed to us by the apostles, God bearing them witness by means of these miracles. So the apostles were given the ability to work miracles in order to gain attestation that they had a supernatural power behind them. Now you notice I've said all the time down here, supernatural power. I haven't said these are evidence that God is the one working these things, because they're not necessarily. Deuteronomy 13, 1 through 5, in fact, has in view false prophets, not true prophets. But they're apparently false prophets with a difference. They're not just the average fakes. They actually can work something. They've got supernatural power. And the classic passage on this matter certainly would be 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, where we see the activity of the Antichrist will definitely involve miraculous works. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, I'll pick up back in verse 8. Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. So, the miracles definitely indicate the presence of a supernatural power. And that at least is one sense in which they are signs, and it's certainly something seen here in the idea of dunamis too. Evidence of a power and ability that men haven't got. And when that's working through men, then apparently there's something there on the basis. Notice it's rather inductive. How do you tell what men have got? Well, grow up and see what men can do and things of that variety. When you see somebody that's doing something way beyond that, out of that whole ballpark, then it's an indication that there's some other powers at work, what we would call supernatural powers. So that is one feature that the miracles do have for their significance. That might not be quite as helpful as you'd like, of course, because it just makes the choice tougher. You know, here you've got God on this side and Satan on this side, and a whole bunch of guys in the middle who are just amateurs trying to fake it or something. Well, it kind of knocks out all the middle ground when you see something that men can't do, but it still leaves you with the two extremes. How do you decide between those sorts of things? Well, another thing that miracles do is that they indicate the character of the supernatural person. Indicate the character of the supernatural person. We can learn something about the source of the miracles by the context in which they occur, by the kind of miracles they are, by the things that go along with them. Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 5, which we just looked at a moment ago, but we didn't go that far, says, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams should come to you, and he should give a sign or a wonder, and that sign or wonder comes true, but then notice the context, concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, let us serve them, and I think that whom you have not known is a parenthesis. The guy's not necessarily advertising the distinction between the gods he's presenting, God and the Bible. Don't listen to this fellow. The Bible explicitly says that God will allow this to happen. It says there's a purpose for it. Notice that right there, following in Deuteronomy 13. The Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, etc. God has set things up in this world so that serving him is not always the easiest thing. In the long run, understanding that he's got control of everything, it is certainly the way that you must go to avoid disaster. But it may not look easiest or best or most exciting at some particular time. Well, God is going to allow others to work miracles and with false theologies, but his purpose for believers in that is to cause them to love God and cling to him in spite of difficulties that might be there. So the message, the theology is drastically awry. You've solved the problem of where the miracles come from. Okay. Galatians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 indicate another problem of that variety. Paul is not actually dealing with such a problem, apparently. He's apparently just dealing with people who have been sold a bill of goods by the Judaizers. But he says, you guys have turned away from the gospel with rather little provocation, but you ought not to turn away under huge provocation. Even if we, Paul, perhaps thinking of the other apostles or Barnabas or Silas or somebody, or an angel from heaven, one step better, should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we have preached to you, let him be accursed. So here we see another feature, another gospel. Now, if Satan comes working miracles, but he doesn't try to turn you to other gods, and he doesn't try to turn you to another gospel, he's wasting his time. What's the profit in that? He's glad to leave preaching the gospel to the righteous, and is not too concerned that his followers should go around preaching the gospel, getting other people saved either. So here's a fairly good test that there will be something drastically wrong with the message, and with the message. And here we see kind of the theology proper and the soteriology, if you like, of the presentation of this material. The works that Satan does are going to be, when viewed at the proper level, evil works, even though he's going to disguise himself as an angel of light. Satan will try to make it as good as he can, just as you put something that's fish-like on the hook. You may not be so excited about worms yourself, but apparently the fish are. You don't put something on that they detest, you don't get any. Well, Satan is going to try to do something that looks good to those around, but it's going to have to have a result that will be drastically harmful, or he's wasting his time. So we see that the type of miracle itself, or the type of phenomena surrounding the miracle, are going to be indications of the character. If the miracle is a prediction, for instance, we're told in Deuteronomy 18 that some of the predictions will not come true. Deuteronomy 18, last half of the chapter, sets up the conditions for a prophet. The prophet was to be an Israelite. He was to be obeyed as speaking with the voice of God. It's implied both in Deuteronomy 18 and Deuteronomy 13, he'll be able to give some evidence that he's a prophet, and that would be either a sign, what we'd think of as a miracle that conveys some information, or a prediction that comes true, which would also be a miracle. And yet we're told in 18, one foolproof way to recognize the fellow is his miracles will occasionally bomb out. And over in Isaiah, that's explained why that's so. Only God controls the universe. Satan doesn't. Satan's got a lot of powers we don't have. We've got a lot of power the savage in the jungle doesn't have. We have automobiles with, 150 horsepower, not to be too outrageous. And so we can go a lot of places, and we can turn corners and signal turns and things of that variety. But we don't have everything together. We may plan to make a left turn and get run over by a trailer truck before we get to the corner or something of that variety. So Satan has got a lot of power we don't have, but he doesn't control the universe. And therefore, no matter how good a tip he gives to his henchmen to make a prediction, they're going to botch it occasionally, because God's the one who controls it. And God is the one who even promises us that he will make fools out of the diviners and cause their predictions to cave in. So these areas, the false theology, the miracles going awry on occasion, think of the miracles on Mount Carmel. Here's Baal and the prophets and his prophets, and here's God and his prophet Elijah. And under those circumstances, God is not going to let Baal get away with the whole thing. He is going to confront him. And so he confutes the prophets, who presumably thought that they could get something of the sort. Why waste your time otherwise? They at least thought it was going to be a draw. I think that's fair to say, or they wouldn't have come. If they had known that they would not go home from the situation, you can be sure the prophets of Baal would have gotten the first boat to Tarshish. So that they did not, I think, indicates that they thought they would either win or it'd be a draw. Well, but God intervened. And in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the passage we were looking at regarding the Antichrist, tells us that other things will show up in connection with satanic miracles. We see, for instance, the lawlessness of the one doing these things. The lawless one will be revealed, verse 8. He is going to be leading people into lawlessness, presumably. He's going to be opposing every so-called god. He's going to be taking God's place, etc. We see some pictures rather clearly there. So recognizing satanic miracles, I think we have some phenomena which are associated with the miracle itself. What about recognizing divine miracles? Well, just as satanic miracles are going to have somewhere in their context something which characterizes the personality of Satan, so divine miracles are invariably going to have in their context, because God is not trying to deceive. Satan, of course, is trying to deceive. God is not trying to deceive. They should clearly have things in them that indicate God's character. Let's notice a few examples of this sort. You remember Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night, and he says, Rabbi, we know you're a teacher from God, because no one can do these things unless God is with him. Now, we don't know exactly what things he had seen. We're told that Jesus had done some miracles before that time, but they're not given to us in detail. But apparently, Nicodemus understood from his theology of what God was like and of what position Israel had in God's plan that God would not allow a fake to be able to do miracles that would be on the level of the things that Moses and Elijah and the great persons of Old Testament time were doing. So he says, we know that you're a teacher come from God. Likewise, over in John 9, the fellow who has been healed there, he says, here's an amazing thing. He's talking to rabbis. He says, you don't know where he's from. You don't know where Jesus is from. And yet he opened my eyes. Verse 31, we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. The Bible doesn't have an apostle or a prophet or Jesus speaking at these two places. One of them is Nicodemus, a very well-trained fellow. The other is kind of an average fellow, but with good common sense. He did know that there are no pictures of healing of blind men in the Old Testament, and apparently none outside as far as Israel's history was concerned. So basically saying the same thing. He's saying God would not allow deception to get away with this sort of thing. Whatever your theology is worth, you're not doing a very good job, he says to the rabbis, of handling the problem of Jesus. Now, Jesus himself argues with the Pharisees because the Pharisees are stuck with a serious problem. They can't deny that Jesus is doing what he claims to be doing, but they're stuck with only two sources at that point. It's either from God or it's from Satan. And since he's not patting them on the back and applauding them for their theology, they say it must be Satan. But Jesus answers them very strongly, very forcefully in Matthew chapter 12 and following, where he points out that the character of his works and the level of power that he is exerting do not fit their picture that it would be Satan. He says, first of all, that to assume that Satan is doing this, you must assume something very absurd for Satan to do. Satan is not a fool. Satan may be wicked, but he's not a fool. You're assuming that Satan, because the large number of demon possessions that have been ended by Jesus, because the large amount of healing that has been done by Jesus, Satan is letting an awful lot of people out from under his control. It's kind of like trying to show your goodwill to someone. You give away two-thirds of your kingdom. Well, that's rather dangerous, because then your whole idea that you're going to sneak around behind them and destroy them is going to be a little tough, particularly when Satan's opponent is God. And God really has everything under control, and Satan is only allowed to continue at his pleasure. Satan can't afford very well to divide his forces and use one half to destroy two-thirds of the other half or something of that sort. So Jesus points out very clearly that the type of miracles he's doing are the wrong sort for that sort. It's the people who are repenting that are getting healed and these sorts of things. It's the people whose lifestyle is changing from bad to good. And that's a little tough. And then he points out, just from a straight methodological point of view, if they're going to say that Jesus is doing them demonically, how can they fairly say that their own disciples who are casting out demons are doing them from God's side? They haven't got the power that Jesus has got. Are they saying that that God can't give the power to the rabbinic disciples, that Satan can give to this heretic Jesus? They're getting themselves into some trouble in that direction. And so he points that out very strongly. And then he points out the way to recognize true and false prophets is by the lifestyle. And he goes into this picture of how you recognize a tree. If you're a botanist, you look at the buds. or you look at the bark, or you look at how big the tree is, or how it branches. But if you're not a botanist, you come up and you look at it and you say, it tastes like a fig. It must be a fig tree, you know, and that sort of thing. So you don't have to be a great specialist to tell the difference between divine and satanic miracles. You just have to know the difference between right and wrong. You just have to understand biblical principles of righteousness, and you can make that decision. And so, of course, the Pharisees try to attack him from that side, but always it turns out that what they find him doing wrong is their additions to the biblical material, not what the biblical material teaches. And the only one they really think they can catch him on, and which is the one they do put him to death on, is blasphemy for claiming to be God. But the trouble is they can never answer his exegesis, why David can call merely a descendant his Lord if that descendant is merely a man. Never really deals with the biblical indications that the Messiah isn't just a man, but has some kind of a divine claim. So I think we see something very strongly there. The character of the works, the level of power, and another very, very important feature that shows up, it shows up quite a few places, but probably as clearly anywhere as in Matthew 11, verses 2 through 6, came about that when Jesus had finished giving instructions to his 12 disciples, he departed from there to teach and preach in their cities, Matthew 11. Now when John in prison heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else?" John is troubled. He, I think, like most people, expected that when the Messiah showed up, that was going to be the kingdom right then. He was going to put an end to oppression and wickedness and all of that sort of thing. And somehow Jesus wasn't doing that. And so John begins to wonder. John had certainly some very good signs early in his ministry, but things aren't going quite the way expected. And besides, he's in prison. And that's not quite the way for the forerunner to the kingdom to be treated. Jesus hadn't apparently come with an army of angels to get him out of prison either. And of course, when you're in prison, I've never been there, but I hear that you can become discouraged very easily with nothing but the walls to look at. And so he asks this. Jesus points to two things. Jesus points to the works he's doing, the miracles, and points to the fact that they're fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. So if you look right in this passage, he says, Jesus answered and said, "Go and report to John what you see and hear. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who keeps from stumbling over me." So you have some references here to Isaiah's prophecies regarding the activity of the Messiah. And they are indications that what Jesus is doing is from God. We can apply these things as well today. We have a picture here of one who comes and says, I'm God's new message for this age. He's got to fit in to the biblical predictions. When Abraham met God, apparently there had been nothing much before that. But as Abraham gets to know God, God says, "Look, your descendants are going to be in a foreign land for 400 years, and they're going to be enslaved, but I'm going to bring them out one day." And so when Moses shows up with the staff and the leper's hand, he can point back and say, I come from the God of Abraham. And this is what he said. This is what's going to happen. And then God leads them out in the wilderness and makes arrangements for the prophets to come. So we have Deuteronomy 18. Don't follow the diviners. Don't go all these things into occultism and such to learn what you need to know, how to get through life. The prophets will tell you what you need to know. They're going to begin to come. They will have certain things that characterize them. And one thing will be that they're going to agree theologically with what you've heard already. We're not going to suddenly change theology at some point. It's going to be the same. Going to be a God of righteousness. Man is not going to be able to be saved by his own abilities. He's going to be saved by God's mercy somehow. Picture in a sacrificial system. This has got to all fit in. And here's a prediction that prophets are going to come. So when they begin coming, it's nothing new. There it is, right? In God's word that the people have as they're in the land. As the prophets begin to come, they begin to tell about this deliverer, the Messiah, the Son of Man, the Son of David, the King, the servant, etc., who's going to come and what he's going to do. And lo and behold, he comes and does it. And he says, "Well, I'm giving my apostles power to bind and to loose, and I will allow them to do greater works than I have done," and things of this sort. They will get things set up. And the apostles, they begin to teach, and they don't say, there's going to be apostles coming all through the period of time. They and Jesus say, "Beware of false prophets, beware of false Christs, etc., etc., etc. And when I come back, says Christ, you'll know it." You don't have to be looking for the signs. Doesn't hurt to look for the signs. You don't have to be looking for the signs. It's like a lightning flash. You can be looking in the wrong direction, and you'll see it, because it lights up the sky. So the Bible is very clear that the next thing we're expecting in God's program is his return, not some new guy with, aha, I'm the guy for your age, and these things that Jesus said, they are canceled out now, and this is the new situation, and I'm the new Messiah or something of that variety. So the miracles attest the presence of supernatural power. They indicate the character of the supernatural person, whether he is satanic or divine. And they teach us something. They teach us some things that you could not learn from providence alone. I think the most important thing we could not learn from providence alone that the miracles teach is redemption. After man has fallen, he can apparently go to hell by himself. Dies by himself. That is, God doesn't have to do anything special. He keeps the universe together, that sort of thing. But he can't be saved by himself. Sin will not pass away by itself. There's got to be an intervention. So those who prefer a universe in which there's no intervention must of necessity figure out some way to explain sin so it's not quite so bad as the Bible pictures it, in order that you don't have to have the miraculous. But in the biblical picture of sin and of God's righteousness, you have to have the miraculous to deal with the problem of sin. That, I think, is the most important teaching message that we have in the miracles. They not only attest the presence of a supernatural power and tell you what kind it is, but they teach redemption. There's another thing they do teach, however, and that's judgment. Many of the miracles are miracles of judgment. Not so many in Jesus' ministry. I think the only miracle I can think of just off the bat in Jesus' ministry that's a miracle of judgment was the withering of the fig tree, where he gave them a picture, a symbolic action, if you like, a sign, but a miraculous one, of what would come from rejecting Christ, what would come from putting on a front of having fruit while not having it, which you can see the application of rather easily from that whole use of the symbolism there. What we'd like to do in the time we've got left, we'd like to look briefly at one miracle just to see some of the things you can get out of a miracle fairly, I think, by examining what's going on in the passage. And one thing we have to do, we want to look at the miracle of the great catch of fish in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. I think it's very, very helpful in reading the miracles of the New Testament and reading the miracles of the Old Testament is to try to put yourself in the place of the people that saw it. That's very hard to do if you grew up in a Christian background, if you've heard the stories from the time you were 2 years old, because you're so used to them, they don't make any impact. They're kind of ho-hum. But that wasn't the way it was with the people then. They were amazed. They flocked out to see Jesus. It really had a huge impact on them. So one rather important principle in interpreting the miraculous, I think it's true of many other things in Scripture, is to try to put yourself back there. Try temporarily to forget what comes after that you already know about, that will, of course, influence it all, and say, how would this have struck a person, a Jew of that period, say, if we're talking one of Jesus' miracles, how would this have affected them when they saw these things happen? Well, let me read for you Luke 5, verses 1 through 11. Now it came about that while the multitude were pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. But the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the multitudes from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for catch." And Simon answered and said, "Master, we've worked hard all night and caught nothing. But at your bidding, I will let down the nets." And when he had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. And they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats, so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear. From now on, you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Now, this passage is early in Jesus' ministry. It's at the call of the first disciples. We know from John that some of these disciples had seen some of his other miracles, but still has made a very great impression upon him. It's apparently the first of the nature miracles. You've got the Cana. Turning the water into wine might fall somewhat in the same category of a nature miracle, in the sense that it's not working on a person. but one of his early miracles. What kind of an impact would this have made on the disciples? Well, you have to ask yourself, what did the disciples know? They knew the Old Testament. These are not pagans, they're Jews. Grown men, they're in a society where the Bible was taught very widely, where even the average person was supposed to learn a large amount of the Bible by heart. So when they see something like this happen, what sort of thing does it call to mind? Well, it calls to mind similar miracles in the Old Testament. Are there any similar miracles in the Old Testament? Well, there are not any water miracles that are very similar. I guess there's Jonah, a little bit different. Here, the fish were caught and eaten. There, Jonah was caught and eaten, a little bit different. But both of them do involve having a fish at the right place at the right time, okay? Perhaps about the same mass of fish at the right place at the right time. We don't know anything about that. So there's some similarity there. That miracle, as far as we can tell, was done by God without the intervention of any prophets or anything of that sort. What he might have used in the way of angels and stuff, I cannot tell you. But that was the case. Other water miracles, opening of the Dead Sea, don't seem to be anything close. Floating of the axe head is certainly unusual. Here, fish swim. Both cases, they were swimming. They weren't doing anything else unusual. So probably the miracle of Jonah would be the nearest sort of thing, though it certainly goes off in a different direction. There are some of the Egyptian plagues that are similar to this. And you remember, they were done by, well, it's hard to say who they're done by God. Okay, that's everybody's safe on that. And they were sort of done at Moses' announcement, but he announced that this was what God was going to do. So Moses was tied in with these rather closely. And there we have the example of the frogs coming up. Mass of frogs suddenly show up in a place where there haven't been a mass of frogs before. And though it's perhaps not something that's never happened before, well, this is probably not something that's never happened before. Occasionally, fishermen get their nets tangled up with a big school of fish. But the timing is certainly rather important in both of them. There's the boat. Throw the net over the side. You know, they've caught nothing all night, but Jesus, even if you're a carpenter, will humor you sort of thing. And I don't know exactly what Peter's opinion of the matter was. But anyway, there the fish arrive at the right time. Well, same thing here. Perhaps there have been big plagues of frogs in Egypt now and then, but the point was here was this fellow Moses, and he says, tomorrow this is what's going to happen because you won't let the Israelites go. And Pharaoh scratches his chin after it happens and says, strange coincidence. But after four or five of those, begin to get the idea it's not a coincidence after all. So when the insects show up next and then the locusts show up, etc., far as we know, these are not miraculous in the sense that God created a bunch of locusts or frogs or something somewhere. It might have. But far as we know, it's not. It's just they show up somehow. God arranged the conditions or moved them around in some way that they're there, and it's unusual, and it's timed. That much is certainly going on. And certainly the fishermen who saw Jesus do this could hardly have failed to remember these events in the Old Testament. Likewise, a provision of quail in the wilderness a couple times in Exodus 16 and Numbers 11 fall in the same kind of category. Oh, the quail fly in. They're apparently even blown in. So they're brought into the right area and brought in by what isn't obviously supernatural, but the number of them and the timing of them and everything is just, it's a miracle. So from this point of view, I think it's very clear to see in these sort of things that there are some Old Testament miracles that are similar in certain things. A sudden provision. Miracles that involve the movement of fish or insects or birds or something of that variety. Those would come. And when you look back in the Old Testament for those, they're associated with the working of God. And in these other cases, they're the working of God directly, as in the case of Jonah, or the working of God with an announcement of some sort through his assistant. It's rather interesting to look at the contrast with Jesus. Jesus doesn't say, oh Lord, show them that I'm your prophet by causing these fish to come in or something. He just says, throw your net out over the right side. And the fish come in. It's rather striking that with only one or two examples, Jesus does not call upon the Father when he does a miracle, because the miracles are intended, I think, to show that his connection with God is different than Moses' connection with God and Elijah's connection with God and these others. He can just do it, and it's done. He does the miracles in a way that Moses doesn't do the miracles or Elijah doesn't do the miracles. So there's one thing. The power shown there is something of a very striking order. It's something of an order that's in the same ballpark with what has happened only once or twice in Jewish history, up to their time. The great time of Moses in the wilderness and the great time of Elijah and Elisha when there was a great danger of apostasy and the Baalism. There's another aspect, I think, that's rather interesting, and I kind of think maybe the disciples, if they were well-versed in Scripture, might have noticed this too. And that's to look at passages that aren't miraculous that have to do with fish in the Old Testament. This is a fish story, not a fish story of the fake type, but a real event. But what does the Bible have to say about fish? Well, of course, it says that God made the fish, that fish are under God's control. Job 12:8, if you want to look that up sometime, speaks of fish as being in the hand of God. Interestingly, man was made to rule the fish. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. To have dominion over, and that lists a bunch of things, and fish is one of them. Man was made to rule the fish. See that in Psalm 8, too. Psalm 8, actually, it is. Man made to have dominion over the fish. But something went wrong. Probably something having to do with the fall. At the fall, the relationship between man and agriculture went awry. And the relationship between husband and wife went awry. Nothing is said specifically about the animals. But after the flood, in Genesis 9, 2, it's explicitly said there's now something wrong with the relationship between man and the animals. Animals will occasionally kill man, and they're to be put to death because of that. But, by and large, the animals are going to fear man. And so the relationship of rule over them is not the right kind of relationship. It's a running away from and fearing sort of situation. And that's certainly basically true now, except with domesticated animals. And even those are often very particular about who they will come to and who they'll obey. So God controls the fish. Man was made to rule the fish, but has fouled it up. In fact, the fish have even gotten tangled up in man's judgment on God. So we see several places where the judgment of God falls on man for his sin. It falls on the land, it falls on the fish, it falls on the animals, etc. as well. Interestingly also, we're told in Ezekiel 47 that there to be many fish in the Messianic age. When the Messiah comes and establishes things and sets things right, even the Dead Sea will have fish, we're told. There'll be a place for catching fish there. So these whole two areas, I think, are rather interesting then, as the disciples see what Jesus is doing. He's doing things that put him at least in a class with Moses and Elijah, and the way he relates to God in doing these seems to suggest he's far higher level than that. And he's doing things that have a messianic flavor to them. Man was supposed to be able to rule the fish. He can't. Perhaps Jesus can. Of course, we don't know exactly how this miracle happened. I don't think there's reason to believe that Jesus created the fish 2 feet away from the net. It's possible, of course. But there were fish in the Sea of Galilee. I certainly think the liberal idea, which you occasionally hear, that Jesus saw the school of fish coming and did it, is unlikely. First of all, it's unlikely. If you know any physics, if Jesus is standing on the shore and the boat's out there about 50 feet, you can't see into the water. The angle's wrong. The light reflects up. You don't see down. You have to be almost over the water to see down. And he wasn't in that circumstance. That, I think, is a problem. You might argue he called the fish. If the fish are to be under man's control, and Jesus is the perfect man, he just signaled the fish or something and they came. I don't know. Or you can figure that because he is God, as God, he controls the fish. Don't know. That's one of the things you get into with miracles. They get into a realm where we don't know. And so there may be a number of ways of understanding a passage that might equally be possible, but we don't know which one actually is the case. So Jesus tells us something about himself. This miracle, although it's in Luke and not particularly called a sign, is in fact a sign of something. It's a sign of who Jesus is, and it's a sign of what he's doing in a certain sense. He's demonstrating dominion over the fish, something which man has lost. I think there's more to it than that as well. It's demonstrating something about the disciples' relationship to nature around them and the disciples' relationship to Jesus. Here are disciples who are trained in fishing. If anybody can catch fish, they ought to be able to. But they spent a whole night using their best efforts and they've caught nothing. Here's someone who's not trained in fishing. Jesus, carpenter, builder. But he can make or break their success in fishing. And in fact, I think we'd have to say, since Jesus was God, it was because of him that they didn't catch any fish the night before. Just as well, and not as spectacular, of course. as being because of him that they caught, we can guess here, at least 2 days' supply of fish in a few minutes with him. I think it's fair to say the Galileans were not ignoramuses. They knew how big to build a fishing boat that you would expect in a day's catch to get it not so full it's going to sink, okay? And they knew how strong to make their nets so that under normal circumstances they wouldn't break. But here's a catch that's breaking their nets and about to sink two fishing boats. It was an unusually big catch. So a very striking picture there, which Jesus uses to show them that they may not think that they're able to do anything in his service in spiritual realms. They're fishermen, but he can make it so they can't do anything in fishing. And he who is not a fisherman can make it so that they could succeed in fishing. So likewise, he's one who can make it so that they can succeed in the work that he is going to call them to. I think it's also interesting to notice that there's a miracle almost identical to this over at the end of the Gospel of John. Liberals, of course, say these are the same story which has gotten wandered around somewhere, things of that sort. you can do anything with the biblical material with those approaches. I think there's a very definite reason why the miracle is repeated, and that's to remind them of this very thing. Jesus is about to leave them now in John 21, and so he shows them again that he is the one who can give them the success they need to serve him properly, and does that by, in their own specialty again, showing them that he's the one who can keep them from getting anything, and he's the one who can allow them to get things as well. So we've tried to look at a few things in this one miracle that can be seen, I think, on a sober exegesis of the passage by looking at what the disciples would have had access to from their Old Testament background and what these things tell us about what Jesus is doing. Our concern, I think, in such passages would be to see the picture of who Jesus is, to see something about the good that he's doing. Here he is actually giving them a rather valuable gift, if you think about it. We can see something about his intervention into the world to bring redemption, not perhaps so clear here in this particular passage, which is not a healing passage or something of that variety, and not a judgment passage either. But I think the hints of redemption in this passage, in speaking of the fact of the estrangement between man and fish because of the fall, and the restoration of that estrangement in the perfect man, who is both God and man, and who is the Messiah, who is going to bring the new creation, who is going to straighten things up.
Biblical Theological Seminary is happy to have brought you this study in God's Word. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.